Today's podcast, like all my podcasts, is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of those patrons, and then we're going to get on with the interview today. First and foremost, I want to thank my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. Sang Lucci and his partner, Charlie Bathgate, if you are a day trader, you have to know about their service. Their Steam Room tracks a lot of money coming into the very illiquid options market to try and telegraph what equities might do. It is a strategy that works. It is a strategy that Lucci has been using for years. He was one of the originators, him and Wall Street Jesus, of using this strategy before other people started to catch on. I would trust them the most with it. He is a friend of mine, and I know that he's an honorable person and he runs a good business. If you're not interested in checking out the Steam Room, by the way, link is in the profile podcast profile description. You can also check out the Sang Lucci Investor Master Course and also the 3LT Playbook, which are the three rules that Lucci used to become a seven-figure trader. If you're interested in those things, check them out in the podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friend Pete over at The Trader's Path. What is The Trader's Path? If you are a day trader, The Trader's Path is a service that might be right for you. What do they do? Well, they trade all day, every day. They have live streams. They trade in options market, equities markets. They trade in green markets and red markets. And right now, Pete is offering a special too. If you don't want to take advantage of their full program, which includes education, it includes advocacy, it includes a chat room, it includes daily watch lists, and it includes that live stream and a great community. If you don't want to take advantage of that and you work maybe a job, but you only trade on the side, he's got a special program geared just for people that trade on the side. So it's a businessman special, and he's taking $100 off the price if you're a QTR podcast listener. So check out The Trader's Path. The link to that is also in my podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is offering a free 14-day trial for listeners of the QTR podcast. What is it? I will tell you. Rumorhound is a piece of AI-based proprietary software that looks at merger and acquisition rumors when they hit chat rooms, hit the news, and generally appear all over the place while you're trading during the day. So what does their service do? It uses a proprietary group of variables to try to determine which rumors may be worth paying attention to and which ones may be worth ignoring. As you guys know, and I know, if you can get ahead of a merger or an acquisition in a public company, a lot of times that can be lucrative business. So Rumorhound wants to make that easy for you. And using their proprietary platform, what they will do is they will do all the hard stuff. They'll look at things like the credibility of the companies and the credibility of the source and the financial viability of the transaction and will spit you out an easy to understand recommendation as to whether or not the rumor is something you should be paying attention to or something you may want to just pass up on. Check out rumorhound.ai. There is a free 14-day trial in the podcast description and their Twitter is at rumorhound. This podcast, finally, also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, Investors Underground, my homie Nate Michaud over there, Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks, Matthew Zimmer, my brother Jay Mintzmyer, my other brother Russ Valenti, and Crichton Titus, and just shouting out some of my longest running supporters like Max Mulvihill, Kyle Thomas, Chris Bede again, Darius Kordonsky. I appreciate you guys very much. I don't want to waste any more time because I've got a wonderful interview today that I am stoked about. I'm honored today to have on the line with me Dr. Ron Paul. Dr. Ron Paul is most of my listeners know who he is already. If you don't, he's a former two-time presidential candidate and Republican congressman from Texas. And he's currently the chairman of the Ron Paul Institute and host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report, one of my favorite podcasts. The link to that is in the podcast description. Dr. Paul, thank you very much for taking some time for us today.
Good to be with you, Chris.
So I wanted to start right off the bat, Dr. Paul, because you are a physician, and ask you about the coronavirus here, which a couple of things I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on. The first was whether or not you believe the statistics coming out of China. I've done some work with China in the past, and so I'm a skeptic. And the second is what you think this potential outbreak might, what type of effect it might have on the markets and on the economy.
Well, the statistics that are coming out aren't too atrocious. The predictions of what's going to happen, millions and millions of people are going to get this and hundreds of thousands of people are going to die, I don't buy into that. I think it's all just, hype. I recall one of my very first week I was in Washington in 1976, there was the swine flu crisis coming up, and Ford was president, and he wanted to do something about it, so he declared a national emergency and an emergency appropriation for $135 million to inoculate everybody in the country, and I and one other doctor, Larry McDonald, voted against this because it didn't make constitutional sense or medical sense. And it turned out that more people died from the flu than they did, more people died from the shot, from the inoculation, than they did from the flu. And after about 4 or 5 months, they had to cancel it because there were so many cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome that was a consequence. So I don't trust the government solution. We were taught in medical school, first do no harm, but politicians don't follow that because first thing they do is more harm. So last year, it was estimated there were 650,000 cases of flu, the ordinary flu, and nobody even talks about that, and people die from it. 8,000 people died in this country from flu last year, but here there's no, I think there's 5 or 6 cases in this country, and nobody's died in this country. Some have, and there's a danger in talking this way because he doesn't care. It isn't a problem. You know, we got to do something about it, but it's way out of proportion, you know, to the amount of attention it should be getting. And I just think that people are overreacting. Matter of fact, it does have a monetary connotation to it because the Fed said this morning when the stocks sort of recovered, don't worry about it. We will take care of it. We will stimulate it if the economy goes down. And our job is to make sure the stock market never drops below 5% of correction. So no matter whether it's flu or whatever, the Fed is there to take care of us. But I think the danger is way overblown, and there's no way that what I'm saying is perfectly clear. I'm just going by what my bets are and
sure
what's happened in the past and what has happened. But I think it's way overblown because it probably started in a narrow sense in China. I think right now they're only talking about less than 140 people have died from it. What are we talking about? 650,000 people died in the past year with flu. So it's all a gimmick probably to sell more vaccines.
Interesting. Have you heard the theories about the origin of the flu being either in the seafood market, but also there was an article I read yesterday about there being a bioweapons facility or a biowarfare lab in Wuhan as well. Do you think that there's a chance that this is some type of strain of the flu or genetic mutation of the flu that you know isn't going to be able to be dealt with? Or do you think that humans will, adjust to it and will be able to come up with a vaccine relatively quickly?
I heard that, and it could be, but I don't think that's our biggest problem because the coronavirus is pretty well known. It's a strain that's been around for a long time, and generally it's not very virulent, and on occasion it will get that way, so that's why you can't say forget about it, this is nothing more than a cold. It could be more, but so far not so. But about whether or not this came out of a laboratory and produced deliberately, I just don't think it's the case. I think there's enough in nature to explain this. Where the problem comes, I think, is in the reporting of it and the hysteria that goes along with it, and then the silliness that the Fed ought to be involved to take care of any financial problems happening in the world because people have panic over the epidemic.
Sure. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Paul. Do you trust the numbers that come out of China? Do you generally, and let's not even just talk the flu numbers that they're giving, but, let's talk about maybe macroeconomic numbers as well. Do you trust that type of data when it comes out of the Chinese government?
Well, no, I would say they're about equal in China to the United States. I don't trust our government statistics. They're always fudged. But the Chinese would do it, whatever they need to do, you know, they do it. That's why we should get rid of 80% of our government, you know, because they're not there for the right purpose, and they're there to do the wrong things and protect the special interests. So I just think that people should assume the statistics aren't very meaningful, and they're always gimmick for certain things. They say there's, you know, like our statisticians say, well, there's no inflation. Well, how do you measure inflation? Do you measure it by the price of a bond? Do you measure it? How do you measure it? Stock prices are high? Oh, no, we do the CPI, and we can control the CPI better than anything else. So that means we can regulate the money supply in order to prop up the stock market. So that's why it's always serving some special interest. And under these conditions, inevitably it's the middle class that ends up paying the bill.
Right.
And so often the left chimes in, oh, yeah, we have to do this. We have to have more food stamps and more welfare benefits. We have to rob the rich and help the poor. But what they're doing is they're destroying the money and they're destroying the middle class.
Yeah, so when the markets are so far removed from whatever the standard deviation should be because of all of the micromanaging in the markets and the Fed intervention, and just generally the way that markets are portrayed to the general public that doesn't have a, you know, good understanding of economics, which is basically that there is no risk, essentially. Like you said, the Fed came out this morning, so they're going to mitigate all risk. How do you even forecast or look into the psychology of what could cause a market break and the timing? Is it just completely unknown at this point? Have we gotten so far off the path?
Yeah, I think the subjectivity is very important. Prices, you know, is a reflection of monetary policy. You print a lot of money, prices, the value of the dollar will go down, or the currency will go down, and will affect, the purchasing power. But to say that we know exactly where the money's going to go and how rapid it will, destroy the standard of living of a lot of people, that is unknown, because right now, I think, even though I see a lot of price inflation of a lot of goods and services, it's really nothing. It doesn't get the attention that the people had in the 1970s when prices were going up like 15%, interest rates were 20%. So it's something that they don't have control, and that just drives them nuts. So therefore, they have to be in denial that because they wanted to do what they plan to do, say print money, and that's going to help the middle class and all these other things. And there's some truth to it too, because I think this tremendous stimulation under Trump, spend, print, and interest rates down to 0% or close to it, it has a short-term benefit to it. But they don't have control of it. The markets are more powerful. The market finally said that this fictitious gold standard under Bretton Woods would end, and it took a long time, but it finally ended because gold was worth more than $35 an ounce. So the markets will rule, but there's a subjective factor, and that's why in Austrian economics you can say there will be distortions, there will be malinvestment, there will be excessive debt, but the whole thing is when the people decide this is a bad idea and they give up and they lose confidence in the system, which they're quite capable of doing, and that's why the Fed has to rush, to the rescue as soon as confidence is shaken a little bit. So the big event will come, and nobody's going to be able to predict today that it's going to occur. But some people say, oh, I think they're on edge because, oh, it's the flu. The flu's going to do us in. We better get the Fed busy. And I never thought I'd live to see the day that the Fed was there to take care of any side effects from the influenza.
Yeah, they can do it all, can't they, Dr. Ball?
All right,
so I just have two more very quick questions for you. The first is, when you look at the Democratic candidates, your friend and my friend, Peter Schiff, said this morning, if Bernie Sanders gets elected, the price of gold will go right to $2,000. I wanted to kind of get your take on what the lesser of the Democratic evils is, do you think? I mean, I know obviously all of their policies likely don't appeal to you as they don't appeal to me, but also what you think the price of gold may do in reaction to whatever direction the election goes this November.
Well, the gold price is going up mainly because the spending is excessive and it's going to continue and it's going to get worse. And it will be monetized, and they will keep interest rates as low as they can get it and make it negative necessary. So that's the reason gold prices will go up. I think I see it in two terms. There's always an excuse for gold to jump $100.
Right.
But the reason is because we're printing too much money. But the sort of things that happen in the economy, well, that's the excuse for us to, you know, they say, oh, there's a war breaking out in the Middle East. We better buy gold. And then it goes up. But the real reason is, of course, because of the monetary system, and that's what has to be dealt with, because it's financing a very evil system when it comes to, you know, the military and also the welfare state. So the elections are important psychologically. If they get Sanders to be president, or it looks like he's going to be, yeah, it's going to be very devastating. But the truth is, something between now and November could cause tremendous downturn in the economy. I don't think it's likely to happen, because it looks like they might get through the election, but it could happen. And then you don't even have to wait for Sanders or Warren to be president, because you already see the hints that are going on. And it's there. It has nothing to do with, you know, radically changing a policy. It's just the acceptance of what we're doing. You know, they're trying to impeach a president just out of clear blue hatred. At the same time, they get together for the spending. They can pause for a day on this hearing. Oh, well, we better take care of our wars. We better fight these wars.
Right.
And they go and do these atrocious things, and they do it together, and they get it done in a couple hours. It's amazing what they do. Nobody pays any attention to in cooperation, but then they have to be seen fighting tooth and nails. And I think they are, you know, responding to their political bases, and they think that's the only way that they can maintain power, because we still need smart managers. We might agree on all this war stuff and welfareism and the Federal Reserve, but we still need smart people. So they're arguing over who's the smartest people to run the country.
Yeah, and when it comes to spending and it comes to continuing to print money, you know, it's amazing how politicians will join together when it's in their interest to stay in office and in their interest to pretend to prevent a catastrophe that would likely have blame placed on both sides of the aisle. So they'd much rather, you know, remain as the status quo. Listen, Dr. Paul, my last question for you, and thank you again for taking some time out of your day for me today. You know, you've had such an exceptional and just honorable career, and you truly are a patriot. When you look back at the decades of public service that you've given to the country, what are the most important pieces of your legacy that you would like to bestow upon the country?
Well, I think other people will have to help determine that, you know, from an objective viewpoint on what I might have contributed. But I think what I personally have noticed and feel good about is that when I went to Washington in the 70s, I was influenced by the breakdown of the Bretton Woods, and I wanted to call attention to monetary policy and the Federal Reserve. And I would say that we've done pretty well on that, and a lot of people know about the Federal Reserve, and I think it's going to be more noticeable, you know, for a long time to come until we get rid of it. You know, when we even got the bill passed twice to audit the Federal Reserve, and believe me, in the 70s, they thought that was really crazy, although that we had that major crisis in 1971, there was no relationship to that crisis and monetary policy and what the Fed was doing. And the other thing I think that we have gained, but not well enough, we still have a lot of work to do, is trying to get more young people, especially, mobilized to say these wars are about the stupidest thing we know.
Right.
You know, drafting young people. I was drafted, you know, for Vietnam and different things like that. The whole principle that we're protecting liberty, it makes me ill when they say, well, he sacrificed his life and his limbs because he is protecting us, our freedoms, and we have to send people over to the Middle East and Iraq and around on all these places to preserve our Constitution. That is sick. And in that kind of comments, you know, all these people pontificating at the hearings, you know, over impeachment, how they talk so soberly about the Constitution. We have a constitutional responsibility. That is so sick when 9 times out of 10 or more, they vote against the Constitution.
Right.
So that's what is needed is more education, and that's why your program is so important, to keep reaching out. And that's where I get encouragement, because I don't know how many people you reach, but I know it's more than you know about, because people spread a message. And even with all these shortcomings coming up with the internet and social media, there's still benefits there. You know, we still use it, but we are always threatened by the social media being in cahoots with the government and undermining our liberties. But messages are spread, and the ideas are important, and they are crucial. It is there where I think we're making progress, and reasons for us to continue the fight.
Yeah, and Dr. Paul, nobody's ever going to be able to say that you voted, you know, that you went out and said one thing and then voted differently, because you have been a beacon of consistency to your message. And I think that's what makes your public service so honorable. And, you know, on behalf of the nation, I thank you for that. I'd also like to say thank you very much just for taking 20 minutes for me today. It was wonderful to speak to you, and I hope in a couple of months, maybe we can catch back up again and talk about things heading into the election.
Thank you, Chris, and we'll do that. And thanks for having me on.
All right, Dr. Paul, take care. That was the one and only Dr. Ron Paul, the guy who turned me into a libertarian to begin with, kind enough to take 20 minutes and share his message with me today, and definitely share a perspective on the coronavirus that is different from what I think, undoubtedly. But Dr. Paul also happens to be a physician, and I am not. So you can score one for all the people on Twitter that tell me to keep my mouth shut, even though that's not going to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you again to Dr. Paul, and I will see you soon. Peace!